This is the last week that we will be in this study for some time, simply because the kids will be back from Master Clubs, and so the topic that we're going to be studying tonight is very adult-oriented, and so we have a lot of information that I want to cover tonight, and so I hope that you will stay with me, that you will get some insight as to how our country has found itself in a place in which it has. Charlie, can you go ahead and bring up the back screen? Galatians 2:20. I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live. Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Our identity must be found in Christ. Everything that we've talked to up to this night, it's all the same. Whether you're talking about racial problems that we have in this country, whether you're talking about the many different facets and difficulties, the ultimate solution and answer to every one of those social problems and social justice issues that we've looked at all come down to the idea whether or not you find your identity in Christ or you're looking for it somewhere else. I was 3 years old when Bruce Jenner captured the hearts of America by winning the gold medal in the men's decathlon. It was 1976 Summer Olympics. Jenner became an instant celebrity and was proclaimed the world's greatest athlete. I can remember getting a box of Wheaties. I still remember him being on the cover of the box of Wheaties. I was very young, but I still remembered that. But do you remember the first time that you heard Bruce Jenner no longer wanted to be Bruce? It was 2015. He was an Olympic champion, an icon, an American hero. He was interviewed by the journalist Diane Sawyer about his experience as a man who had long lived with a deep secret. All his life, he's been revered as a model of athleticism and, listen, masculinity. Bruce Jenner really believed that he was a woman, and he defined himself as a transgender. I watched a scant 2 or 3 minutes of the interview, and let me tell you what I saw. Someone that was deeply hurt, wounded, still looking for some kind of peace. He had wealth. He had celebrity. But yet, he did not have self-acceptance. Where does our self-acceptance come from? It comes from our identity in Jesus Christ. You fast forward from that interview just a few short months, and he makes a surprise appearance on the magazine cover of a famous worldly magazine. For him, it was an act of self-actualization. And really, his appearance signaled a transition to fully identifying and living as a woman. The cover proclaimed this: "Call me Caitlin." Let me tell you what the message was of that magazine and of Bruce Jenner's transformation, if you will. The message was clear. Men can become women if they feel, or even if they just perceive themselves to be a woman, and vice versa. And let me tell you, the media was eating it up. They couldn't get enough. News quickly came that Jenner was going to star in a reality TV documenting his transformation. I've never seen 1 second of that, and I don't care to, and I hope you don't go looking for it. His new Twitter account under this new identity broke records in how quickly it gained millions listen to me, millions of new followers. And so this idea of being transgender just was catapulted to the front of our culture at a rapid and breathtaking pace. Listen, transgenderism had really been a topic that barely registered on most people's radar before he made national and really world news. And now, all of a sudden, gender identity became the most fashionable social justice issue of that day. Let me tell you something. The Christian church, the local church, but the local churches in the West, we face a new set of challenges that, in my opinion, far exceed anything that our culture has experienced up till now. The sexual revolution has fundamentally restructured our culture and our understanding of what family is, what society is, and even what the absolute meaning of life is. It's been turned upside down on its head. And so this revolution, like every revolution that's come before it, takes no prisoners. It demands total and complete acceptance of these revolutionary claims and the affirmation of its claims. It's not even enough just to be neutral in these culture wars. You have to not just say it's up to you. You have to embrace what they believe. So the problem that we as Christians who are committed to the uncompromising faithfulness of the inerrant, infallible Word of God, really, we're faced with a challenge. In Jude 3, we're told that we should be earnestly contending for the faith. But a lot of times we're on the sideline. Even more than this, now I wouldn't even say an undercurrent, but this overt normalization that we've seen over the last 25 to 30 years of my lifetime of the normalization of homosexuality, the transgender revolution has really aimed at the very foundation, more so even than homosexuality, of the very structures of our society. Transgenderism disagrees and goes counter to thousands of years of what would be considered common consensus regarding gender and human identity shared by every culture and every nation, including even those that have little to no influence by Christianity. Now, I found this illustration. Some preschools in Europe prohibit the use of gender pronouns, eradicating terms such as girl and boy from the school. Now, that's just one small, ridiculous example among many, demonstrating, however, why the transgender revolution raises questions that you and I are not going to be able to avoid. By the way, it's going to be one of the most challenging aspects of ministry that you and I are going to face in this next generation. Just as churches in this country have been having to deal with people struggling with same-sex attraction, by the way, when you normalize deviant behavior, you can expect more deviant behavior. All right? And so all I'm saying is you're going to see more and more and more of this. It's not that it's just becoming public. You're exposing a whole other generation to what used to be called an alternate lifestyle. It's not alternate anymore. The Christian lifestyle is now becoming an alternate lifestyle. And so churches, I believe, not may, but churches will be struggling with same-sex attraction, or people that are dealing with same-sex sex attractions. Churches will be ministering to men and women struggling with gender dysphoria or gender confusion. We can't just push it out and put our head in the sand and just read the news and say, boy, I'm glad that's not in Shelby. If you don't think it's in Shelby, you've not been to Walmart. I think we're going to have a biblical response to this transgender revolution. It's going to require our church to develop, really, I would say, new skills of compassion and understanding as we deal with those who are struggling. Let me just say this from the outstart, or from the very beginning. People that are struggling with transgenderism are no more sinful than those that lie, than those that are obese, than those that may have a nicotine addiction. That's the sins of the flesh. Listen, those are no different than those of us that would lust, that would covet. Do you understand? And so we cannot afford to be disgusted or angry at people who are lost, living like lost people. Now, I'm not saying anything about approving of that lifestyle. I hope you understand that. But we've got to change a mindset of condescension to being, boy, I'm glad I'm not like them. Does that now sound like a parable to you? Now, how do we get to this place? I think before we can really understand what the answer is, we must understand where the problem starts. We've got so much information, I think I just need to compress it just a little bit. One of the reasons why Christians must confront this transgender revolution and why we must faithfully continue to preach the gospel, while we must minister to those that are outside of Christ, because God tells us we have to love our neighbor. We speak much of the Samaritan man, and we all think we're that Samaritan. But my question is, how much helping have you been doing? Fighting, pointed question. But it's meant to shake us into a reality that says, are we really doing what God's called us to do? I read one article that says, you may be praying that you never have to deal with this. But it finishes with this thought, you'd better be praying that you will to deal with it. Are you ready to point struggling? Healing, forgiveness, and peace that they're so desperately looking for, and acceptance. And hitting social justice issues the last several weeks, but you have to understand this falls into that category. The same injustice that black people are claiming that they're still under are those that the LGBT plus crowd is claiming. So I think it's important to understand this dynamic, to understand some things about that word that we talked about, intersectionality. I keep promising we're going to talk about it. Maybe we will someday. Just understand this. Intersectionality is just a scorecard to see how many different levels of oppression that you are under. Zero is a white male Christian, or a white Christian male. So anything you go out of there, you're at least oppressed in one way or another. All right? So if you're black, that's one. If you're a black female, that would be. If you are a black female that is a homosexual, then, you know, keep. And so the more intersectionality that you can put behind your identity, the more influence you have to be able to speak on behalf of those that are oppressed. So it's kind of like a pecking order, if I could put it that way. LGBT community, intersectionality, and all that, it's an integral component to that ideology. Now, 2015 was like a long time ago from today. But do you understand that Facebook offers over 50 different gender options to its members? Now, the article I got that from, it might be old. It might be more than now. Wasn't it just a couple of years ago that we were debating about restroom usage here in North Carolina? States like New York are fining citizens who fail to use the preferred pronoun of a transgender citizen. It is coming to a town near you. And it is happening so fast. It's hard to keep up, let alone understand the debate. The goalposts keep moving. Relativism. How do we get to where we are? Well, one of the torrents that is pouring into our society is this idea of relativism. It says that the meaning and truth are relative. What's right for one person may not be right for someone else. You might have heard someone say something like this. You might have even thought it yourself. That may be fine for you, but not for me. Someone else that is struggling with relativism often has a problem with authority, and they say things like, "You can't tell me what to do." Why? What comes along with relativism is individuality. Now listen, I know we are rugged individualists here in America, and I don't think that's terrible when you talk about being productive and looking at society as individuals, institution. But when you are so individualistic, you're not willing to submit yourself to authority, there's a problem with that. And so relativism denies any one right way to understand the world. There are many stories, but no grand story. So let's put that in a way maybe you've seen it before. I mean, what says Christianity is right? You say that's right. What about those that believe in Islam? What about Judaism? What about Hinduism? You understand? And listen, I don't know about you, but here in Shelby, just a couple of years ago, I was knocking on a door, and the guy on the other side, he was not Oriental, but he said he was a Buddhist. The next week, I ran into somebody else. Now, it's been several years before I've since I've met somebody, but 2 weeks in a row, I met two people that were claiming to be Buddhist, and they were very relativistic. Well, Christianity is fine for you, but I'm looking for nirvana, or whatever it was. So religion is just really just one example of how someone could choose to live his life, but it's not authoritative necessarily for everyone. And so what happens, any attempt to claim that it is really just a ruse to gain power or authority over someone else. And really, haven't we seen that before? Somebody that's using religion, somebody that's using a position to try to gain authority or power over someone else. And so that all goes into the mix. Also, we're living, I believe, in a post-Christian culture. Now, let me explain what I'm saying. By most all accounts, statistics, Christianity right now is in decline in the West. Now, I believe there are some places, whether you go to the Philippines, I think the underground church in China, and I don't think ever Christianity, until the trumpet sounds, can be extinguished. I want you to understand that. But you can see from our society, no matter how hard it is to measure decline or get the right statistics, Christianity's influence is dying a slow death here in the West. That means the moral truths that Christianity teaches have less and less impact with each passing year and each passing generation. It's clear that fewer people are attending church, which means at least the outward devotion to Christianity that people used to give is slowly receding. You know, there is definitely a growing biblical illiteracy. That means that individuals are growing more and more unfamiliar with simple Bible narratives, simple Bible truths. I remember asking a child, this is 15 years ago, asking a child, do you know what sin is? I said, no. Where are they going to learn it if they're not going to church? Mom and dad's not teaching them what it is. The school system certainly is not going to teach them what it is. Culture, whether you're talking about entertainment or books or magazines, they're not going to talk about it. We are getting further and further away from a biblical literate society. They're unfamiliar with simple biblical truth, or what we would call absolute truth, which, by the way, is the opposite. So with this influence, that means there's a greater opportunity for another value or ethical system to come up and displace Christian morality. No one disputes that this change is felt, especially in the area of sexual ethics. Over the last generation, there's been a growing acceptance of homosexual relationships. I mean, our Supreme Court affirmed, I can't even call it marriage, I'll just be honest with you. God defines marriage in a woman. But you want to call it unions, pseudo, whatever. Our society has not only allowed it, but embraced it. And so all of these social changes can only take place in the context where Christian ways of understanding the world are seen as optional, irrelevant, archaic, or, as we see increasingly, as hateful. Every single society ever has some form of morality. Now, let me be clear. What is the definition of morality? The quality of being in accordance with standards of right or good conduct. Now, the question I'm asking you tonight is, who gets to define what is right and good? Do you understand? We are used to living in a world where biblical morality has reigned supreme for many generations. But as I said, that's waning. So the question is, whose morality is going to reign supreme? Anytime there's a passing of a moral framework, another one has to be constructed in its place. And I'll tell you, I believe the evidence suggests that there's a secular framework. That's what this whole social justice is. Remember, it's based on Marxism, humanism. Just the same as the Christian morality used to be heralded, whether it was in schools or from the church or from the government, you now have a secular morality that is being heralded from many churches, from the schoolhouse, and the government institutions. And so this post-Christian world leads just about 50 or 60 years ago to the sexual revolution of the 1960s. It gave rise to the idea, if it feels good, do it. I don't think there's any greater stream feeding this current climate, then that revolution's revolt against what they considered Puritan or prudish behavior. We would call it biblical morality. You understand? So the upheaval of this revolution taught that our bodies are our own. A direct contradiction to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 18 through 20. And because they're our own, they're for us to enjoy in whatever way we want. And whether it is physical intimacy, whether it's drugs, whatever it might be. And if you have any desire to see how this revolution has impacted the world, look at our entertainment industry. In every aspect, in every corner of it, there is an unchallenged, and I would submit to you, an unchallengeable assumption that sexual freedom is the highest standard for personal fulfillment. No longer is physical intimacy assumed to take place only in the confines of holy matrimony. The idea that this physicalness outside of marriage is wrong has been overturned. Our culture has descended from wait until you're married to the physical act is something that should occur when you really love someone, to if you want him to like you, you need to be intimate, down to a base hookup culture that has no emotional impact, nothing but devastating emotional impact. No time, no responsibility, and by the way, no intimacy. Let me give you another stream. Somehow I didn't write it in there. You can write it down. It's a very familiar word. It's called Gnosticism. Gnosticism. In my study, I came across this idea and I started studying it out, and I was surprised to see Gnosticism, although an ancient view, is, I believe, very prevalent in worldview of people today. Gnosticism is simply an ancient view that matter is evil and spiritual is good. And in ancient times, it predated Christianity. It permeated much of the early church, and Paul spent a lot of his time writing against the heresy of Gnosticism, but it taught the world or matter evil, and all that really matters is for a person to see the spiritual and escape, to get away from the physical or the world. Gnosticism emphasizes that a person's self-awareness is different than and more important than their physical body. Gnosticism says that there is an inherent tension between our true selves and the bodies that we inhabit. Can you kind of see where I'm going with this already? The idea that our true identity is different than the body we live in communicates that our body is something less than us. And so we can be used, shaped, changed, altered to match how we feel. The concept that our gender can be different than our biological sex is a modern form of the old Gnostic teachings. Let me tell you what this means. Practically, is that a man can identify as a woman even if they have the male XY chromosomes and the body of a man, but he can still claim to be a woman. These are the torrents that are flooding into our society, and they explain why the transgender debate has not just come to the forefront of our culture, cultural consciousness, but why it's moving so rapidly. It didn't come from out of nowhere. It's coming from all these different streams, coming from every different direction. Sometimes unnoticed, all the time publicly unchallenged. You know, It's ironic to me that those that preach tolerance and inclusion will assign really the greatest sin as being the first to judge someone else. To say this is wrong is what I'm saying. To say that there is an absolute truth. There is tolerance for everyone except those that believe that there is a standard of right and wrong that is above personal choice. The second sin that you can commit against a post-Christian world worldview is to fail to fulfill your desires. To fail to follow your heart. To not fulfill whatever joy is going to make you happy. Let's talk about gender for just a moment. Let me just say this. Gender does not mean what it used to. I spent almost my entire ministry avoiding the word sex from behind the pulpit. And I feel compelled tonight because there is such a dichotomy in the understanding of what gender is. And so sex, gender, and gender identity really are different things to different people now. And I think that we have to define terms. And I want you to understand when you hear something in a headline, what are they saying? It's not what are they saying to like they do. And so in today's culture, there's several different ways to think about a person's biological sex. Sex can refer to our biological makeup, our composition. As I mentioned earlier, men have XY chromosomes, women have XX chromosomes. There are hormonal and reproductive differences, obviously, between men and women that result from chromosomal differences. That's biology 101. And that's what we think of. I mean, from our bodies all the way down to the cellular level with those chromosomes, the biological sex of those born men and those born women are different. There is a difference. I mean, the Bible makes it clear there's a difference, but I'm telling you scientifically, as you know, there is a difference. By the way, there's just difference in the way that God created men and different men and women. We're different. Men tend to have broader shoulders than women. These are generalities, but they're pretty. Women tend to have wider hips. I read that, okay? Men tend to be than women. If your wife is stronger than you, just say yes, ma'am. That's what we think of as gender, but according to the American Psychological Association, gender refers to the attitudes, are you listening? The feelings and the behaviors that a given culture associates with a person's biological sex. And so in traditional societies, and I would say that have been going for millennia now, really until the last decade or so in parts of the West, gender has always been attached to biological sex. It's a culturally appropriate expression of your sex. So if biology says you're female, your gender is female. So gender in different cultures, I think, have been pretty expressed in much similar ways as what in America. I can remember being up in West Virginia during missions conference. We had put posters on the wall from many different countries and things like that. And I never had a problem wondering if that was a woman or a man in the picture, because they were expressing themselves biologically as the same as their gender. I hope I just didn't make that muddy. But the problem we have today is that many now see gender as being detached from their biological sex. That is, you don't just express gender differently, like a different culture. You can be a different gender altogether because it's no longer linked to biology. Your biology may be female, but that does not necessarily mean that you, as regards to your gender, are female. Now remember, I'm talking from a worldly perspective. I'm not stating this as fact. I'm just helping you to understand how someone can say that biology and gender are two separate things. They've separated them. It's that Gnostic point of view that really what you feel inside is more important than the body that you reside in. By the way, we're the first generation that are able to seek to make biology follow gender and not the other way around. There are now medical procedures that allow people who are born male, who identify their gender as female, to have their bodies surgically altered to reflect that female gender. By the way, they don't change their chromosomes. I want you to know that. But that is how we end up with a phrase like gender identity. Did I skip one? There it is. Gender identity is a person's self-perception of whether they are male or female, masculine or feminine. By the way, do you know all of us have gender identity? Every one of us does. We don't experience what I'm about to explain in gender dysphoria, but we identify with the way that God made us. We have a gender identity. Now, I've started off telling you what the answer is. The answer is not identifying just biologically the way you were born. The answer is to identify yourself in Christ. And from that outflows absolute truth about how God made and designed people. And so when someone experiences distress, inner anguish, or discomfort from sensing a conflict between their gender identity and their biological sex, that person is experiencing gender dysphoria, a mismatch between the gender that matches their biology and the gender they feel themselves to be. Now, I want you to look up here for just a moment. I want you to pay attention. It's crucial as Christians to understand that this is a genuine experience. Just like same-sex attraction. The answer used to be, just like girls if you're a boy. I think we need to move past that and understand the Bible has the answer, but counseling and embracing biblical truth is the answer. The same is true for those that are experiencing gender dysphoria. People with gender dysphoria are feeling that their biological body is lying to them. And a person in that situation will often think that he or she should be or would feel better as the gender that is opposite to their biological sex, or oftentimes no gender at all. By the way, that doesn't mean that someone who is experiencing gender dysphoria is automatically a transgender. All right? It's when somebody begins to act on those feelings. When they take a step in that direction, and they may experience a conflict between their gender identity and their biological biology that God's given them. But a person that is experiencing that dysphoria may very well choose to live in alignment with the way that God. So I would say, I like what one said. He said, dysphoria is an experience. It is not necessarily a lens or an identity through which a person must view their life. But, yes, sir. Yes. whether it's a temptation to commit fornication or adultery or any temptation, it's acting on those feelings. You're absolutely right. But I guess I'm trying just to help you to see that really that's the conclusion I want you to come to, is that this sin is simply that. It's a temptation to sin. And so transgender is really more of an umbrella term for the state or condition of those that are identifying and expressing a gender identity that doesn't match that person's genetic makeup. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about how that can manifest itself, but that's how you end up with drag queens reading in a library to children. May end up with hormonal treatments. And by the way, that is the biggest form of child abuse, I believe, that can be perpetrated on a young person. Now, I'm not for any kind of child abuse. I think it's all wicked. But you can heal from just about any other type of trauma. But hormone blockers and surgery are irreversible. And to think that a country that would not let a person vote because they don't have enough sense to know who to vote for, not to be able to really drive or do anything else, but will allow them to start taking hormone blockers is, first of all, it's illogical, but it is absolutely wicked. So this idea of relativism. I have to ask the question. Andrew Walker, in his book God and the Transgender Debate, gives three questions on where people go to look for answers. They look for authority, who has the right to tell me what to do, knowledge, who knows what is best for me to do, and trustworthiness, who loves me and wants what is best for me. You see, if you can find someone or something that can fill all three of those slots, then you're going to go in that direction. The problem is that this generation, where is it left to look for the source of authority, knowledge, and trustworthiness? Where are they looking? They've rejected God's word. They've rejected absolute authority. And the conclusion is, it must be me, myself, and I. I mean, who has more right to tell me how to live than me? Who knows better than me? Who can I trust to want what's best for me more than me? Now, there's a lot of fallacies in that logic. I want you to postmodernism and post-individualism agrees with that model. The sexual revolution tells me that the highest goal is self-fulfillment achieved through following my feelings, and relativism makes it possible for me to pursue these goals being allowed to say no, wrong, according to our reason. But really, that's being gracious, because most people aren't following their reason. They're following their feelings. Think about how often you hear or maybe say things like this. I feel like, or I think that, listen, it's so part of our culture that we hardly even notice it, even when we're using it. However, we as Christians, that it is God who has the authority. It is God who has, it is God is trustworthy. And when He tells us to do something, that something is actually what is going to bring us liberty and freedom. John 8:32 says that ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. James 1 into the perfect law of liberty and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. There is so when we tell others, even when we tell ourselves, to obey God, what are we saying? What we're saying is that we ought to give God what he deserves, which is what? Our obedience. And we want to give to us what is best for us, which is what? Your obedience. You know, that's why Christians will end up holding views or believing things that go against the culture or go against what may come naturally or even instinctively. Why? We listen to what God has to say and not what we ourselves have to say. We don't just say, well, that's the way I've always thought, or that's the way I grew up. I'm going to finish with an illustration, and I'm going to share some verses. But I want you to imagine yourself on a tour of an airplane manufacturing plant. There to see this new cutting-edge model, and as you begin your tour, you talk to the engineers about the overall design. They talk about the plane's speed, its power, its seating capacity, and next you head on to the floor of the plant where the hundreds of workers each have a unique task. You stroll past each station. Workers are assembling the engine. There's a station for all the wiring and the cockpit instrumentation. And further down the factory floor, you see workers putting upholstery on seats that are going to go inside the plane. Each is working from a plan. Then, at the very end of the this facility, you see the plane sitting there itself. Almost a skeleton of a plane. But a design is taking shape that's going to make an heavy object defy gravity and fly at amazing speed. And if any of these workers fail to meet the expectations, something could go wrong with the plane. A mistake in construction or constructing the engine, or a failure to tighten the propeller components properly, could lead to catastrophe. And so every part of the plane is designed intentionally. Nothing there happens by accident or by guesswork. And each part of the plane is relying on the other parts of the plane to do their job so it can do its job. The parts are interlinked and interdependent. Can I tell you? We look at we see a very similar illustration. We see the story take shape as we read how that God created the world. You see, there was a designer. There was an architect of the human body. And he had a plan for how he was going not just our body, but our world. God had a blueprint in mind when he spoke. And once he had built his creation, in Genesis 1:31, he saw everything that he made, and behold, it was very good. God's creation was very good. God's act of and every part, it was intentional in every part. Genesis 1 and 2 shows that the God of the Bible doesn't create chaos, but he creates according to his purpose. Let me tell you something about God's purpose. It is genius. It is brilliant. And it is very good. Sorry, got behind. God is the one that has all the answers. Let's talk about identity just for a few minutes. We started out with Galatians 2:20, I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. I wish we had enough time just to exegete this. We could spend the rest of the summer on this one verse. The life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. How do you know that you can trust God to do what's best for you? This verse tells you. He's willing to sacrifice. He gave himself for you so that his best could be for you. That's how you know you can trust God. Brother Bill hit on it. He hit me, got to it a little quicker than I did, but I'm crucified with Christ. It is so easy to stand and look down and shake and wag our finger at those people that might be struggling with sexual dysphoria, those that are struggling with same-sex attraction. Certainly, we look at those that are involved and immerse themselves in lifestyle. But I ask you this evening, are you crucified with Christ? I'm not asking you to compare yourself to somebody that you would look at their sin and say, that's revolting. How could anyone do that? Christ were to stand and look at your besetting sin, would he say, that is disgusting. How could anyone do that? And I don't care if it's a lie. I don't care if it's just 1 ounce of pride, as though pride could be measured in that way. Are we crucified with Christ? First Corinthians 3:23 says, "Are Christ's, and God is, and Christ is God." Where does your identity lie? Does it lie in being a student at Ambassador? Does it lie in being a preacher of the gospel? Does it lie in some form of vocation? Most men identify themselves with what they do. You meet somebody new, they say, oh, what do you do? You don't generally say, well, I'm pretty good at marriage and I'm a father. No, I would say something like, I pastor Maranatha Baptist Church. I identify with what we do. I'm talking especially to men. Women do to some degree, but they would be probably more prone to say, I am a mother, and they look relationally. But still, that's not the right identity, not the primary identity. Clearly, our identity is to be in Jesus Christ. We belong to Christ. Paul is telling the church of Corinth, ye are Christ's. Where is your identity? Oh, the world, a lot of people's identities are up in sports. Is swallowed up in just trivial things that have no value. Some people is swallowed up in politics and sexuality and all these different things. And God is saying, listen, all those things will work themselves out if you will identify with me first and foremost. That means if you identify with Christ, if you come to the realization and live in the reality that you are Christ, then everything you do should outflow from that identity. I don't know anybody, I think maybe I've told you, I knew this guy who's a Niners fan. He's married to my mom, and I wondered, I mean, I never saw him with an article of clothing that didn't have 40, a hat, a jacket, a shirt, something. And I was like, did you live in San Francisco? No, I've never lived in San Francisco. He would get upset and his day would be ruined if that team lost. And he had to have the best day ever the further they made it into the playoffs. And I've never watched a game with him. I don't know, because I'd be afraid I'd root for the wrong team. Not really. But I'm telling you, people around him would not root for anybody but the 49ers because he was so excited and exuberant And let me put it this way. He would never root for anyone other than the 49ers. He was a fan. You know a fan? For that are willing to follow the Lord Jesus and live in a way that is counter to the culture, that is counter to what people might think as relative. And there is truth, and God has given it to us in His Word, and I identify with it because I identify with the author of it. Let me give you just two more passages. We'll not read through them. I'm just going to give them to you. Romans 8, 7 through 11 talks about, and now if any man have not the Spirit of Christ, he is none of His. But if you do have the Spirit of Christ, then that means you are all of His. Romans 8, 7 through 11. I thought I had one more. That's the last one I have in my notes as well. I've given you a lot of information. What I want you to walk out of here with today is to understand that our world is spiraling ever faster in a direction that's away from biblical morality. And it's not for us just to throw up our hands and say, what a terrible world in which we live. It means it's time for us to get equipped. It means it's time for us to look out and say, what difference can I make for Jesus Christ? And it's to make sure that each and every one of us tonight reaffirm our identity. And that should be as a child of God through Jesus Christ.